This is the Lasting Legislative Review, a program of analysis and discussion of issues facing the Alaska State Legislature, featuring the faculty and staff of the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Tonight, our guest is Dr. John Whitehead, Professor of History at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and tonight we'll be focusing on hydropower and the issue of hydropower development. Thanks for being on the show, John.
Well, thanks for having me, Scott.
I guess I'd like to start with take a look at the background of hydropower development in the state of Alaska. Could you pick somewhere, a good point of beginning, say in territorial days, and kind of bring us up to the present with what the outline of events has been with hydropower?
Okay, hydropower is an old, old source of energy in Alaska. It's been around for almost 100 years now. Hydropower can be very simple in its organization. You can have a very small little water wheel driving a very small generator, and many such installations were put in the early as the 1880s for salmon canneries. And then they were later used quite extensively down in Juneau for gold mining operations. The famous Treadwell Mills developed hydropower installations, had done it by the turn of the century.
Mm-hmm.
Then the great increase in hydropower took place again in Juneau about a little before World War I, when the Juneau Mills were getting to be so big and prosperous that they were looking for a year-round supply of hydroelectric power. Now, the early power had been seasonal. When the winter came and the stream runoff was less, there was no electricity, they had to produce it by steam. Then about 1913 to 1916, some of the most advanced small hydroelectric installations in the world were constructed down at Juneau, the principal ones being Salmon Creek Reservoir and the Annex Creek Reservoir. They were built by private industry, by gold mining companies, right before the First World War, and they were so advanced and so good that both of those facilities have been running continuously to the present day, and a good bit of Juneau's electricity is still produced by these hydro plants that were installed before the First World War. So that was the first big splash with hydro in Juneau. Then, in territorial days, Ketchikan, which has, of course, the most rain of any place in Alaska, had early developed hydroelectric power in the 1910s and 20s, so that throughout territorial days, electricity was cheaper in Ketchikan than any other place in Alaska, and it was cheaper than the U.S. average because there was so much water and it could be so easily tapped that Ketchikan became Alaska's really first all-electric city. Later on, again in territorial days right after the Second World War, the federal government built the Aklutna plant in Anchorage, because after the war, Anchorage was in an absolute electricity crisis. You could hardly turn on your lights in Anchorage. In fact, right after the war, to produce electricity, the federal government had to get a beached Liberty ship and use its internal steam boiler to produce electricity for the city of Anchorage. So the Anchorage power supply after the Second World War came from a beached and deserted warship. So the Aklutna plant opened in about 1955, which was the first really big hydroelectric installation in Alaska. It was, of course, built by the federal government. Then there was to be a lot of hydro development in Anchorage in the 1960s until natural gas was discovered. And with the discovery of natural gas, both on the Kenai Peninsula and then the Beluga fields, gas-generated electricity became about half the price of hydropower, and the big project that was all ready to go on board in the early 60s was the Bradley Lake project down near Homer. The plans for that, it was authorized by the Congress, but then construction was immediately suspended or dropped because gas-produced power would have been half the price of hydro. Then In the early 1970s, our largest hydroelectric facility, the Sedisham Project, down in Juneau, opened, again built by the federal government. Then in the last few years, we've had a host of new hydro plants to undergo construction and completion. The Solomon Gulch plant down in Valdez just went online a couple of years ago. Sitka has two hydro projects. One's the Blue Lake Project, which started up in about 61, and then the Green Lake Project opened, I think, just last summer. And then the newest one that is going online is the Tai Project near Petersburg, and then another project in Ketchikan called the Swan Lake Project should go online sometime in December. So that's a rough sketch of our development, but it's a very old development here in Alaska, stretching all the way back to the turn of the century. So hydropower is not something new or something experimental for Alaska. We've had a long record with it.
It seems that there's a wide range that you can pick and choose from to develop hydro. It can be on the scale of Sedisham, or it can be on a much smaller scale.
Oh yes, hydro can go from, well, Sedisham is our largest. It's a small project. Has about, I think Sedisham is about 43,000 kilowatts. The Susitna project would be 1,600,000 kilowatts of power. And the biggest project ever conceived in North America would have been the Rampart project, which was pushed around and advocated back in the 60s. It would have dammed the Yukon River and almost have produced enough power to light the entire Pacific coast until the 21st century. So you can go all the way from a tiny little, almost model-type generator producing just enough light to power a light bulb, all the way up to producing enough power to keep the Pacific coast going. The only problem with the Rampart project, well, there were many problems, but a principal one would have been building a transmission line from the Rampart project to wherever the power would have been used.
Now, hydropower development, these are all major capital projects as far as the state of Alaska is concerned. The local projects that we've seen in the past few years, Swan Lake, Terror Lake, Tai Lake,
mm-hmm.
all these projects. What instrumentality of the state is responsible for these projects?
Usually a project is conceived by a local utility. Whether this is a municipal utility or one of our REA, Rural Electric Association utilities, usually the desire for the production of power comes from a utility. And the utility can then seek any number of ways to get the project built. It can float its own bonds, or in the last few years, it has looked to the state of Alaska, which created, I believe in about 1976, an instrumentality called the Alaska Power Authority. And this Alaska Power Authority was the agency that was set up to receive funds from the legislature to aid in the development of hydroelectric facilities. It can do all sorts of things, from reconnaissance studies for the feasibility of a project. It can lend money to a utility or a municipality to build a project. And in recent legislation, its power has been expanded not only to lend money, but actually to be the owner of hydroelectric projects. So it can do a whole host of things. But you don't have to go to the Alaska Power Authority to get a hydro plant built. It's just, at the moment, the most lucrative source of funds for a utility looking for power.
I see. What kind of record of success have hydropower projects enjoyed in Alaska?
It's from the projects I've had a look at, the success, I would say, has been relatively good. So far as I can find, there have been no hydro projects in the state which have worn out. The ones in Juneau, which I mentioned, have been going for over 60, 65 years. Some hydro projects have been abandoned because there was no more need for the power in the area where they were located, but the record has been quite good with dependable service. There's only been one so-called disaster in the Alaska hydro story, and that was down in Ketchikan, where the municipal utility there had built a hydro plant called the Silvis Hydroelectric Plant, and this consisted of a dam up in the hinterlands of Ketchikan, the dam would then produce a reservoir of water, and the water would then come down via pipe to a powerhouse a good number of feet below the dam. Well, back in 1969, there was a major amount of rain in Ketchikan, more than usual. The dam overflowed, the water came over the spillway of the dam, and trickled down the mountain face in front of it, and the mud and rocks from the mountain finally gave way and buried the powerhouse. The Silvis project was our only disaster, but the Ketchikaners finally dug out of the dirt, and after much debate as to whether they should have built it in the first place, rebuilt the Silvis project. But other than that, there have been no disastrous problems with the operation of our hydro plant. So what has caused inconvenience and problem have been failures in the transmission lines. And this is particularly the case in Juneau. Way back in 1916, they had problems with power lines falling down because the Juneau terrain can be rugged, and to build a power line from where the hydro plant is to downtown Juneau, sometimes you have to go over rather high mountains where your line can be subject to snow avalanches, hurricanes, winds, almost the most terrible conditions in Alaska. So the early line from Annex Creek to Juneau used to blow down all the time. Then later, in the 1970s, unfortunately, the transmission line built to connect Juneau with Snettisham blew down the first 3 months after Snettisham had been operating, so Juneau was plunged into darkness on Christmas Eve one year, a fact the Juneauites didn't like at all. So there's been a problem with the transmission line, and the technology necessary to lay large underwater cables has either been too expensive or the level of technology wasn't as advanced as it might be. So there's always been a technological problem and a financial one in putting in underwater cables. Snettisham had hoped to have an underwater cable, but both the price and the technology were out of the picture, and so the overhead line has been the one that's chosen. But a lot of people don't realize that the transmission line can be sometimes a much greater problem in supplying power from a hydro plant than the operation of the turbines or the availability of water. That's been the principal problem.
So Alaska has had a long and fairly successful history with hydropower.
Yes.
And there is renewed emphasis on it now, arising out of the fact that there was a so-called energy crisis in the 70s, mm-hmm. having to do with fossil fuels.
Right.
How about the interior of Alaska? It seems apparent that Southeast Alaska and coastal Alaska is well suited to hydropower, but how about places like Fairbanks or the bush? What kind of value can hydropower, how useful can it be in those places?
There are something like 700 potential hydropower sites in Alaska, places where either streams or mountain lakes could be tapped for hydropower. The numbers that are economically feasible in the interior and the Arctic are not great. There was, in the past, a small hydropower plant here in Fairbanks out in Chattanooga, which I'm told was damaged by the 1967 flood, and which was not then made inoperable, but it was never redeveloped and rehabilitated after the flood. But the The sites that the Alaska Power Authority is looking at for development are basically not in the interior. Of course, the Yukon project, the Rampart project, was in the interior, but that one is not being thought about again. And the Susitna project, which is, 250 miles south of here, is about the farthest north project that's seriously being considered. So hydropower for the interior would basically have to be, in any large quantity, produced at some distance from the interior and brought in by a transmission line. Of course, we're in the process of building this rail belt intertie. And once it's completed, the hydropower could be brought from anywhere in South Central Alaska to the interior. Some people have noted, and I think properly, that since this transmission line will be so crucial to any successful operation of hydropower being brought to the interior, that it may be wise to wait for that intertie to be built and give it several years of operating experience to see whether the transmission line will work. One of the problems with Susitna is it's out in the middle of nowhere, and its market is either 250 miles to the north or about 125, 150 miles to the south. And so the successful operation of that intertie line is absolutely crucial to any future development of hydropower for the Fairbanks area.
Now, I'm familiar with a concept called, it's not intertie, but it's a method by which you connect different hydroelectric power projects and create a
mm-hmm.
grid.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any plans to create a grid in southeast Alaska with the numerous projects down there?
Well, the only place existing in Alaska today where there's really a power grid is in South Central Alaska. I mean, the Anchorage area, where you have the Aklutna plant supplies power up as high as far north as Palmer, then into Anchorage. Then the system of the Chugach Electric Authority, which has a hydro plant down on Kenai Peninsula at Cooper Landing, is interconnected to supply power not only to Anchorage, but down to Homer and Seward. So you do have a successful grid in South Central Alaska. Down in Southeast, there have always been plans, particularly coming out of the federal government, to create a Southeast Alaska power pool. The reason being that any available hydropower site has a certain capacity to it. And the development of the site is really only economical if you exploit all the capacity the site has to offer. Sometimes you get a problem in which the power market is not really big enough for the site. To some extent, I think we have this problem with the Tai'i project near Wrangell and Petersburg. It has really a lot more power than those two little towns would really demand. Now, the problem with the power line or a grid is simply this. Power cannot be transmitted over overhead alternating current lines for very great distances without a substantial loss in the power. You lose a lot along the way. The way you would transmit power would be through DC conversion, and the best way to do this is through underwater cables. And so the technology which would be used would be to take AC power from the hydro plant, convert it to DC, put it through an underground cable so you wouldn't lose it, and then reconvert it to AC when it gets to its demand area. Now, the Alaska Power Administration, which is a federal agency, has long been investigating the development of possible underground cables, for instance, to take power from Snettisham to Sitka. When Tai'i was being developed, there was a great proposal that an underground cable should connect Tai'i to Ketchikan. But both the expense of these cables and the technology has not led to any great plans at the moment to develop a Southeast power grid. And this is one of the problems. It would be much better if we had a grid, because then you could build what might be the most economically feasible large plant in an area that is not necessarily near where the power would be sold. But we just, it's been a dream and a proposal as far back as the 1960s, but it's never gotten off the ground.
All right, I'd like to talk specifically for a little bit about the Susitna project. And I know right now before the legislature, Susitna is being discussed, as it has been for the past several years. I guess I'd like to begin with asking, what is the Susitna blackmail clause? A lot of us read and hear about this, but I'm not sure that many people really understand what it means. Could you enlighten us a little bit about that?
Okay, I'm not completely sure I understand all the ramifications of the Susitna blackmail clause, but in essence, it is sort of a rider or an amendment to an appropriation bill first enacted by the 1981 Alaska legislature, which was going to appropriate large sums of money for the development of hydropower projects all over, particularly all over Southeast and South Central. It's going to appropriate money for Sitka and Ketchikan and Kodiak and Wrangell and Petersburg. Well, the Anchorage members of the legislature wanted to make sure that they had the votes from their pals in Southeast to get an appropriation for the Susitna project at some future time when the feasibility studies were complete, when the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission license was granted. They didn't want other people to have their hydro plants built and then say, well, we've got our plant, why should we vote money for you now? So that was put into this appropriation bill a rider, basically, which said that these, the grant of money, being these would be gifts to municipalities, that that money that was going to be given would become a loan at 10% interest if $5 billion was not appropriated, I believe that's the sum, to an unnamed hydro project at some time in the future. Well, everyone knew it meant Susitna. So the reason it's called a blackmail clause is simply this. A hydro project is a large capital-intensive item. The interest that's paid on it, the interest rate, the finance charge, is a major item in its expense. So, for example, let's say if you were to build a plant at Sitka and the money was given to you by the state, you might be able to sell electricity at a very cheap price, maybe 2 cents a kilowatt hour. If that gift was then turned into a loan at 10%, the price of electricity might skip up by a factor of 3 or 4. It might become 6, 7, 8 cents a kilowatt hour. So people could be getting cheap electricity and suddenly find that their power bills were tripling and doubling. So it was hoped with that blackmail clause that if municipalities accepted the money from the state, then at some time down the road, fearing for their power rates, they would automatically vote money for Susitna. It's interesting to note that Sitka refused the money which the legislature had appropriated for it. It had appropriated $60 million to give Sitka Green Lake. But the fear of this blackmail clause caused the mayor and the city council of Sitka to tell the state thanks but no thanks for $60 million. They would prefer to have control over their power rates rather than to face the ups and downs of the legislature for the next 5 years. So,
what are we facing, what are we looking at with Susitna right now? At what stage of consideration and development is the project?
I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that the state, a feasibility study has been done, and the Alaska Power Authority has now been authorized to seek a license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. All hydro projects which are not built by the federal government must seek a license to be built. And so at the moment, the power authority is seeking the granting of this license by the federal government. And if that license is granted, then that would be the green light to go ahead and appropriate funds for construction. I think it takes a couple of years to get that license.
I see. When hydropower, is there a time in the future where Alaska might fully reach its full hydropower potential? Is there a time where we can get rid of our dependence on fossil fuels for energy and power production and rely solely on hydropower?
Well, we could solely rely on hydropower if we were to build all the projects which are available in the state. The question would be whether those projects would produce electricity cheaper than the available fossil fuels, particularly natural gas.
Okay, John. Thank you very much. It's a very interesting subject. I'd like to pursue it some more sometime.
Well, call me again.
Okay. Thanks for being on the show. This has been Alaskan Legislative Review. Tonight we've been discussing hydropower in Alaska with Professor John Whitehead of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm your host, Scott Sterling. Our executive producer is Carla Tanella. If you would like a cassette copy of tonight's program, please send $5 to KUAC-FM, University of Alaska Fairbanks, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701. Alaskan Legislative Review is a production of KUAC-FM.